The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salner & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Salner & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Saunier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition. We're going to do our best today to answer the questions you've sent in, mostly by email. A few of them come in via phone calls, and actually we are set up technology-wise to take live phone calls while we live stream this, which happens usually between 1:30 and 2:30 Mountain Time on Tuesdays. We stream over the Mixler app, so those of you who are interested in getting this hot off the presses fresh instead of later on recorded and reposted on the podcast on iTunes or other podcasting software can listen live at that point, and we can take live calls. The phone number to call, if you're interested, is 970-530-0556. That'll actually not dial into the studio here directly, but you'll get a hold of Laura or Shauna. They'll let us know that you're on the line, and we can take your call. The vast majority of people send in their questions by going to our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And on there, you'll find a contact form. You can send in questions directly there. You can research a little bit more about us if you're interested. But that's how to send in questions. Today we've got questions on a variety of things. I heard bucketing was one of the questions. I heard tax planning window, which we've talked about in the past. I'm sure we've got, I would suspect we still have some questions about the SECURE Act, which went into force here in January 1st of 2020. Jim is actually the holder of all the questions, so he can fill us in on the details themselves. So, Jim,
Chris,
welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you for the great introduction, by the way. You're getting better at that.
Oh, thanks.
You've only been doing it for what?
Just kind of winging it.
10 years now?
Yeah. I should write down a script or something, I guess, because I just kind of say what comes to mind. And every show's a little different, so.
Well, you did well.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
Okay. Yes, we did get a lot of questions in this week. We got some questions on the SECURE Act. We've got a few questions where the people disagree passionately with you.
Again?
Yeah. And we'll get to them.
There's a mysterious ladder
it's the gutta,
showing up in the second floor window here.
The gutta cleaner is here.
Okay. I was a little concerned.
For those who did send in emails disagreeing with Chris, then we're going to get to them next week.
Oh, next week.
Yeah, we're not going to get to them this week.
Okay. We had one last week, and
we had one
they
last
disagreed
week
vehemently with something you said, but
no,
I tried to defend you.
I think it was you. I think we'll B's, even though they say I disagree with you, Jim, I think they meant to type Chris. It's clearly a typo.
We'll see. Okay. Well.
But they're more tax-related questions. And the tax team was downstairs, and I asked if they would want to come on the show today. And they're way too busy, and they said no. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Guess they're running the show now.
Apparently. So I asked, will they come on next week? And they said yes. So next week we'll get to those questions where people disagreed with Chris. Okay. Today we have people who agree with us, which is always good. And we'll answer some of their questions.
You mean agreed with me?
No, us.
If they disagree with me, shouldn't they be agreeing with me as well? We'll see.
It's my show. I can pick who's being disagreed with and who's being agreed with. Okay. So this one is from I'm going to guess Tennessee based on what they wrote, but I'm not quite sure if they're a Tennessean or not. Okay, it begins. Hi, Jim and Chris. Mm-hmm. Go Pats. Well, that didn't work very well. Y'all can stop with the Go Pats because they're not going to go anywhere. Although, did you watch the football games this week? They were good.
They were good. Yeah.
Except for the KC game, which started good because I'm not a huge KC fan.
Yeah, that was a weird game.
But then, oh, my God. Patrick just, he came back like crazy.
Yeah, I think we're probably going to have a 49ers-Chiefs Super Bowl.
Yeah, certainly not going to be, it's not going to be Ravens, and everybody thought the Ravens were, but Tennessee put them in their place after putting us in our place, but which was not hard to do. The Pats really sucked this year. But I am surprised Tennessee beat, this is appropriate, a Tennessee email, and we're talking about the Tennessee football team. Mm. But... is Tennessee going to be able to beat
Chiefs.
Chiefs, thank you. I don't know.
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
No.
You think Patrick Mahomes is going to?
And others, they do have some talent on that team.
Oh, Kelce is just phenomenal. Yeah. He's like the new Gronkowski.
He's like a Gronk wannabe. Yeah.
Not a wannabe, he's up there. Yeah, he's in. He's like Gronk was several years ago. But anyways, we don't want to turn this into Stock Jock Show. So we're going to get in from an email from a Tennessean. Hi, Jim and Chris. Go Pats. I do appreciate your Go Pats, but it didn't really help me that much this year. And, of course, if Tom Brady leaves, it's going to...
Thought we weren't talking about this anymore.
I'm just saying how despondent I'm going to be if Tom Brady leaves.
It's going to happen at some point. You need to brace yourself.
Another year or two. Mm-hmm. But he may leave this year.
He's
he
closer to the end
back.
Than the beginning.
Well, he's a free agent this year. Mm-hmm. First time ever. So, but who's going to want a 43-year-old? I don't know. All right. First of all, Jim, you do not want to live in Kentucky. Mm. Move to Tennessee near Chattanooga instead. Mm. You George Clooney-looking fella. Well, I like this person. Except I don't think I would move to Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Why?
It's too hot down there.
Pardon me?
It is hotter than Kentucky in Chattanooga, I'm sure.
I don't think so.
Dude, Kentucky is further north.
That means nothing.
No, it does mean something. The further north you go, the less hot it is.
That's like saying Cheyenne is farther north than Fort Collins. It's close. Back there, everything's close.
Chattanooga is not Kentucky and vice versa. Anyways, first of all, Jim, you do not want to live in Kentucky. Move to Tennessee near Chattanooga.
Where it's cooler and drier.
Kentucky is cooler and drier than Chattanooga, Tennessee. Seriously, though, I love the show and listen every week. I'm a do-it-yourselfer, but plan to turn my accounts over when I move from the accumulation phase to the decumulation phase. Hmm. My question is this. Mm-hmm. How can I, as a do-it-yourselfer, put myself in the best position for the tax planning window? Mm. I would love you guys to do an EDU show all about how to best capitalize on the tax planning window. Are we keeping a list of possible EDU topics? I think you were.
I'm not.
I thought you were.
I don't recall that, but I can start a list. I have a piece of paper right here. I'll start. So maximizing tax planning window.
Yeah. How best to capitalize on the tax planning window. EDU show on the tax planning window is what she's asking for.
Okay,
and what a couple or individual should do to be in the best position. Thank you so much for the podcast. Okay. What can you do? You need tax diversification.
Yeah, I was gonna say the big D.
Yeah, the big D. You see, the idea of let's explain to listeners who, especially if they're a new listener and don't quite understand what the tax planning window is. What Chris and I try to get you to understand, and we call it a window, or Chris termed it a window, because it's open temporarily, and then for most people, it slams shut again.
Sounds like a window.
Like a window. Mm-hmm. Now, everyone's tax planning window looks different, and some people have a window that's cracked open and is going to stay open forever. Other people have a window that's opened and closed, and some people have a tax planning window that never opens.
It's painted shut.
Yeah, it's painted shut. Mm-hmm. What do we mean by that? What it simply means is that there's really three, if you stop and think about it, folks, there are three tax planning opportunities you will have. You have the period of time between now and retirement. Now, for those of you who are already retired, that period is already gone. But for a lot of our listeners, there's the period of time now until retirement. Then Chris and I call the time between retirement and required minimum distributions, which for eons had been age 70 and a half, or at least since the 1960s, had been 70 and a half, and are now, or is now, 72. And then you have the period from 72 till mortality. Those are three, in our opinion, separate periods for tax analysis, if you will, and sandwiched in between now until retirement and 72 until death is what we call the tax planning window, because it's the period of time between retirement and required minimum distributions when you are in control of the income you declare. For the most part, some people are more in control than others. But you decide, should you take money out of an IRA or a 401k? Should you take money out of a bank or brokerage account? Should you take money out of a Roth? These are accounts that we call always taxable. Those are IRAs, 401ks, meaning money that comes out is always going to be subject to taxes. Maybe taxable, a bank and brokerage account, especially a brokerage account. The money you take out may be subject to taxes. It depends. It may be subject to capital gains taxes. It may be subject to income taxes. And then we have accounts that are never taxable. That would be like a Roth account. And to a lesser degree, Chris and I are not huge fans of cash value life insurance, but we do know a lot of people are. And borrowing cash value from your life insurance is also, quote unquote, tax-free. It may be tax-free, but you're paying interest on it when you borrow. But that's a whole other story. So you have those three types of tax diversification. Always taxable, maybe taxable, never taxable. During that tax planning window, between retirement and now, under the Secure Act, age 72, you are technically in control, correct, Chris? You decide what you do.
You are, to the extent that you have created flexibility for yourself in the way that you have accumulated assets over time. If you've accumulated only one kind of asset, you have control, but not a lot of choice. You don't have a lot of control if the only place you can distribute money from is from an always taxable account, for instance. One and only one place that you can get it. So then there's very little choices that you can make, even though you are technically in control. It's when you have created tax diversification for yourself, which is to have different types of holdings that are treated differently from a tax perspective, that you now can, with your own choices, hopefully improve your lifetime tax situation. In other words, make choices that will keep more money in your pocket available for you to spend rather than it being shaved off to go to taxes at the federal and or state level. So that's the whole reason why we focus on or point out to people that they should focus upon the tax planning window to the extent that they have one. And if you're young enough, you should take actions, in our opinion, to create a tax planning window of opportunity for yourself. For those of you who have already created your situation, it's kind of you've made your bed, now you have to lie in it. But hopefully you've ended up with a situation where you have some flexibility. And then there's always a few people that really have so little flexibility, they don't effectively have a tax planning window that opens up. It just is what it is. There's not much they can proactively do to change their tax situation for the better.
And that's what I wanted to talk to her about, because she wanted to know what can she do now as she's waiting to get to retirement. Well, what you need to be doing, everybody, not just our Tennessean listener, but everybody, look at your tax diversification. Now, the industry calls them qualified, non-qualified, and Roth. We call them always taxable, maybe taxable, never taxable. In an ideal situation, you'll probably have a third in all of them. A third, a third, a third would be a great situation. Another good situation would be 50-50 between maybe and never. You don't want 100% in always or 90, 93, 95% in always, which we see a lot, Chris. Mm-hmm. And that's the unfortunate thing, because if all your money is in always taxable, and you retire at 60, you retire early, you got a potential window, Chris, of 12 years, but the analogy you gave, that window was probably painted shut.
It is for flexibility, and you just kind of have to hope that you don't have a very scary post-age 72 or post-RMD situation. Some people have all taxable, but the levels are low enough where they don't really have that much. We don't want to paint a horrific story for everybody. If you're out there thinking, oh my gosh, I have all my money in my 401k or my TSP or whatever it happens to be, it isn't guaranteeing that you're doomed to pay excess taxes because you didn't diversify. But those of you that have, in particular, a scary looking post RMD.
Those listeners situation, who have a seven figure portfolio that is always taxable.
Right. Those are the concerning ones where you really hope or want to have created this tax planning window and know how to and take steps to take advantage of it.
Because the idea is to project your taxes and look at the brackets you're going to be in. When we do, let me explain, and we're doing a whole series of EDU shows right now on our particular philosophy and approach to retirement planning. So when we get into the actual plans that Chris programs, Chris, you specifically tell our software to spend maybe taxable assets first, even though that's not what we want to necessarily tell our clients to do, we program it.
And we do that, essentially that will show us the largest potential tax planning window that can be generated with your mix of assets. So essentially, we step back and say, okay, how big is their window? How much opportunity is there for making choices in recognizing income for tax purposes, income being ordinary income as well as capital gains that might be in there. And by doing that kind of as our baseline, we can look at opportunity. Then we strategize from that point once
exactly.
We identify the opening of the window itself.
Right. So we're trying to project, do you even have a window? Well, some people, because they have all their money in always taxable accounts, and even though they're retiring, they still got to come up with the nearly, if not more, the same amount of money they were spending prior to retirement, if not more. And if they have to take all their money from always taxable accounts, you can kind of see there's no window. There's very little opportunity there. If we need to generate that money from always taxable. But if you had maybe taxable and never taxable assets, we could manipulate withdrawals to keep your tax brackets or your tax liability during this window period very low or non-existent. Why? Not so you can pat yourself on the back and say, wow, I went another 5 years or 10 years or 12 years without having to pay taxes. This is great. I am smart. It's not that we want you to do that. It's that we want to then give you the opportunity to start taking money out of your always taxable accounts, the IRAs, the 401ks, the TSPs, the 457s and 403bs of the world. We want you to start taking money out during that tax planning window, if you will, and fill your lower brackets, the 10 bracket, the 12 bracket, the 24 bracket, or the 22 bracket now. If projections show, Chris, with RMDs, with this million or $2 million or $3 million always taxable account you have, your required distributions are going to push you into the 24 or 28 bracket or higher. Then you can start to see the opportunity, the window, if you will. If I do nothing, I'm going to be forced into this very high bracket. So during this period where I'm not being forced to take required minimum distributions, I'm going to live off of maybe and never taxable assets and selectively fill my tax brackets with Roth conversions. And that's what it comes down to, is trying to do those types of projections. So the single best thing you can do now as a pre-retiree is review your tax diversification and see if it needs improving.
That's a great way to think of it. If you're closer to retirement than farther, I don't know how old this person was and how far they are away. If you're close enough where you're getting a pretty clear view of what your tax planning window looks like, what your future RMD situation will look like, and what tax brackets you're probably going to be in, you can additionally make some decisions as far as, over the next 3-4 years as I finalize my career here, I'm going to direct all my retirement savings to Roths, if it makes sense, if you see that. Or, I've got plenty in Roths. My tax situation looks such that it makes more sense for me to defer instead. So I'll use the traditional choices in retirement. Or I should be saving outside of these retirement accounts for this, that, or the other reason. So it's you can make some more specific decisions, particularly if you're close enough to have a much clearer view. If you're in your 30s or 40s, there's no reason to peer ahead and project what your tax brackets are going to be in your 60s and 70s, because that's so far off. I don't care what your projections are, they're wrong, because taxes are going to change over that period of time almost for sure. So it's really more specific decisions obviously could be made if you have reliable info, which essentially means it's close enough that you can rely upon. You're looking ahead into the future because it's not that far away. So it depends a little bit on your situation. But generally, where we see people have the greatest ability to take advantage of the tax planning window, it's those people who have diversification in their holdings. Not diversification as far as what you're invested in, but diversification as far as what types of accounts you hold for under what tax rules. Always taxable, maybe taxable, never taxable.
Okay, here is a question on bucketing.
Okay.
And this one, too, is going to be very similar to this question. He's asking more theoretical questions to kind of get a grasp of what bucketing is and isn't. But it begins, Jim and Professor Stein.
Whoa.
Yeah, imagine that.
Imagine that.
How's Mary Ann?
And the professor?
Professor Ann, Mary Ann.
I picked up on
it.
Okay,
you got that?
I got that. Now, technically, for under full disclosure,
the professor wasn't a real professor?
No, I'm not a real professor either.
No, you're an instructor.
I am an instructor or lecturer by title.
What's the difference between a professor and a lecturer?
A professor in the academic world means that you have a Ph.D., or a terminal degree in your area, and I do not have such a designation. So I have a master's degree in finance.
So is Scott, the gentleman who helps us in the office, who has a PhD in finance, is he a professor?
He is. There's two aspects of it. It's both that and technically the position that you were hired into at the university. If you're in the tenure track position, those are technically the professor labels, although there is some variation from institution to institution. But for the most part, if you're considered a professor, you fall into that category. Now, can you have a PhD and be hired as a lecturer? Yes, that usually means you're in a position where you're not doing research, which most professors do. They teach and do research in their area of specialty. But now we're diverging not into a football talk, but into a
different Well, that's thing, the thing. Somebody yelled squirrel and you went.
I don't want anybody out there who actually is a professor to say, wait a minute, Chris is holding himself out as a professor.
No,
and he's really not.
No,
I'm technically not.
Yep. Okay. So, hi, Jim, and how about technical Professor Stein?
Wannabe Professor Stein, how about that?
How about just Stein? Okay. Hey, Jim and Stein.
Perfect.
Okay.
I've answered to worse.
Love the show. Have a question on bucketing. Mm-hmm. How is your implementation of bucketing different from just plain old asset allocation? Hmm. Where bucket one, not I, he has the one looks like an I, where bucket one is cash, bucket two is bonds, and bucket three is simply stocks. You're going to say something?
No, I love how he's asking the question because it actually shows he's quite perceptive.
Okay.
He's quite perceptive because our use of the word bucketing arguably is different than other people's use of the word bucketing.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I understand bucketing for fun expenses, but in the end, does it all boil down to just a chunk of allocated assets being specifically designated just for your fun expenses? Yes. That's in the end what it is. Now, one caveat, just like Chris gave this long, drawn-out squirrel type of caveat on being a professor. Didn't stay on topic like I do. I do want to say bucketing goes by many different variations, has many different meanings. There is no universally accepted approach. There are more and more books coming out on it, advisors trying to co-opt, if you will, the whole concept of bucketing. There's annuity companies coming out with bucketing sayings that they're trying to trademark, and there's just a lot on bucketing. It's unfortunately becoming overused. You could call it jarring, boxing, closeting. It is just a euphemism, in my opinion, to help you visualize the spending of your assets. That's how Chris and I look at it.
Yeah, and I like to look at it a little even beyond that when we think about it, but go ahead.
I just want to finish my train of thought because of what he said.
Sure, yeah.
I've often said on this show, our approach to bucketing is nothing more than visualized asset allocation. And I'll explain why we do it under bucketing and why I call it visualized asset allocation. But to us, and I'll let Chris continue, but to us, bucketing is a spending plan. It's not about saving and growing. It's about consuming and positioning your assets to be consumed and ensuring that when it's time to consume a certain tranche of assets, they are there and available and ready to be consumed. They haven't been tied up in something that's going to keep you from liquefying it, or it hasn't been lost to quote-unquote Wall Street, if you will, in a bad or temporarily bad investment. But in my oh-so-humble opinion, and the way we use bucketing, bucketing is geared towards the consumption of assets, and I consider it visualized asset allocation. How do you look at it?
Very similar, but it is ultimately, they hit the nail on the head, that it is just a form of asset allocation. But from our perspective, you know, there's different reasons to allocate your assets the way they are. sometimes there's a rule of thumb. A lot of people have been told that you should hold in your portfolio, you should turn your asset allocation dial based on your age. That's a what we would call a rule of thumb, that no one's making a rule for you personally, but just saying in general, people who are 20 years old might want to hold 20% in bonds, 80% in equities. Or someone who's 60 years old, maybe 60% in bonds, 40% in equity. It was just kind of a rule of thumb, made it easy to follow. And what they were drilling in there is the fact that you might want to consider, or you should be thinking about dialing down your risk exposure as you age, because you're moving into the consumption phase. Now, rule of thumbs usually have some element of justification or truth behind them, especially those that have been broadly accepted. In our approach, and this is our approach to everything, instead of using a rule of thumb that may apply to you or may not, we look at your personal situation and encourage you to create rules that fit you. What I mean by that is, why do we allocate assets? Variety of reasons, but one reason, the main reason in retirement, is so they can be spent and support your planned spending intentions, if you will. Now, back to what I said, if you have a rule of thumb where a 60-year-old, all 60-year-olds following the rule of thumb would have 60% of their assets in bonds or fixed income versus equities if they're following that. Well, I would argue immediately, does that mean every 60-year-old needs that kind of allocation? And what justifies that? Just because of their age, that is what should be driving this? No, in our opinion, what should be driving this is how your assets need to support what they were amassed to do in the first place. They were amassed for you now to spend in retirement. And if I took 100 60-year-olds, I'd get 100 different spending intentions. Everyone is unique and different as to when they want to spend and on what they want to spend their money. So we've said, let's look at this asset allocation thing and not let your age be the driver, but rather the goal of using the assets being the driving force. Essentially, kind of a common sense visualized allocation of assets based on what you intend to use the assets for and when you intend to use them. That's all that we're saying. Now, we call it bucketing because it seems that this stuff kind of, these asset groups, I don't want to use the word buckets to describe buckets, but these groups of assets are meant to support three kind of timeline events, timelines of Jim used tranches. That's a phrase that's used in the finance world, particularly in fixed income or bonds. But the tranches of the first couple years, and then maybe the 3 to 8 years category, and then the long term, nine and more, because your retirement might be some 30 years in length. And what your spending intentions are in those three areas seem to be a great justification for allocating assets to support spending in those three areas, and we just refer to it as bucketing in that regard. But they're absolutely right. It's asset allocation, and I would refer to it as customized asset allocation for you based on your personal spending intentions.
It's a strategy used for the consumption of wealth, not the creation of wealth. Keep that in mind. That's the visualization of the asset allocation that I'm talking about. It's really designed to consume your assets. You are correct. At our most basic level, it is the reserving of fund money to spend at certain periods of time. If you used one mutual fund for that, if you said, hey, I'm now retired, I want to be in a moderate portfolio, I'm going to use this XYZ moderate allocation fund. That's fine. And one fund, especially an allocation fund, Chris, moderate allocation fund will be 60% equities, 40% bonds for the most part, although I've seen some 50-50 moderate allocation funds as well. They'll also have a spattering of cash in there. They will own thousands of individual investments, well-diversified even though you're only in one fund. They're generally group managed, so you're not stuck with one fund manager. They could have three or four people managing them. Very simple and easy fund to use. Mm-hmm. The problem is you couldn't, if you're consuming assets and the portfolio is down because the economy is slowing and it's a down year, so your fund is down, you could pull from the website of the fund all their holdings. You could see some holdings, Chris, are going to be still up. Others are down. You can't call them and say, hey, I need $75,000 this year. I've got $2 million in that fund with you. I can see from your holdings some are up. Can you please just sell those for me so I don't suffer a capital loss? Because overall, your fund is down 18% year to date. You can see that's impossible with a fund. But bucketing is simply saying the money that I'm going to spend over the next few years is in cash. Money that I'm going to spend between, say, year 3 and year 10 is in principal protection. And money from year 11 on, I'm still going to leave invested and can be mostly equity driven. You are taking that asset allocation fund, that moderate allocation fund, ripping the cash out, mm-hmm. putting it in little cash, ripping the fixed income pot out, putting it in the middle, although we don't generally use just bonds for our bucket two, and then keeping the equities in bucket three. Mm-hmm. So that's why I call it visual asset allocation. So you are correct, listener. It is asset allocation. It's just visualized. It helps you avoid sequential risk, the risk that when you need some money, your investment is down. Well, bucket one and bucket two is designed to not be down. It also eliminates the difficulty of saying, hey, I can't selectively call a fund and ask it to sell certain pots of it. I have to sell the whole thing. I got to throw out the bathwater with the baby.
Or vice versa.
The other way around, the baby mm-hmm. with the bathwater. And I'm going to just peel that out right now and visualize it. So you are correct. It's a form of asset allocation, but it's asset allocation for the consumption of assets. It is a strategy that Chris and I use to consume assets.
To position assets for consumption.
It is mm-hmm. not to be used to grow assets. Grow assets, you don't need all these different buckets. Just grow the damn assets. And as you get retired or close to retirement, we call it pre-bucketing. When you get to that period, 2, 3, 4 years from retirement, and you get a little nervous, start positioning some of those assets. You may not be crunching the numbers exactly. You may be trying to guesstimate, what am I going to need for the first 2 years or so of retirement? What am I going to need for years 3 to 6 or 7? And what am I going to need for 8 to 12 maybe? And start positioning some of those assets loosely, kind of on the back of an envelope, if you will, calculation. And then when you get very close to retirement and you get a really good picture of what you're going to need, then you will polish up your actual bucketing plan. But the key we want all our listeners to know, the way Chris and I use bucketing, it is for the consumption of assets. We do not use it for growth, nor do we use it for the sale of annuities. Bucketing is very big in the insurance world as mm-hmm. pools for various annuities. Here is an annuity that's going to pay out for 5 years. And then here is an annuity that's going to turn on in year 6 and pay out for another 5 years. And then here's an annuity that's going to turn on in year 11 and pay out for another 5 years. And they sell you a series of deferred income annuities. We don't like that because life changes and you don't want to lock yourself in.
Right, but that's another way that the industry, different areas of the industry, uses the word bucketing.
Exactly.
It would be very different than our intention of using it. I also wanted to point out that Jim mentioned bucketing for fun stuff, which in our philosophy, the only thing that you're going to bucket is for fun spending, and for minimum dignity floor spending that occurs in the delay period until all of your secure income comes on. Because in our philosophy, you've covered your minimum dignity floor or most required expenses with secure income. There's no bucketing needed for that.
Exactly.
So there is, we don't apply bucketing to everything, but I would point out that someone who's not using our philosophy, who's using a withdrawal strategy, would, even if they wanted to embrace bucketing, they could. They're just going to bucket for all their expenses,
exactly,
rather than just the fun stuff, which is we are. So ours is a little nuanced in that we apply this bucketing or asset allocation positioning for spending for fun stuff and for a finite period of minimum dignity floor, an identifiable period we call the delay period, because it's when we are delaying the turning on of any Social Security or pensions or income annuities that we're intentionally delaying their turn on, or maybe we're not eligible to turn them on yet. You might have expenses in the near term that would not be fund expenses, but rather minimum dignity floor expenses that we would consider in our bucketing strategy.
Absolutely. And we'll get into that because that's not going to make sense to a lot of people. It makes sense to Chris and I because we do this for a living. But a lot of people sitting there scratching their head saying, what the hell did Chris just say? Listen to a series of EDU shows. We're going to be doing probably 3 to 5. My gut tells me to be closer to 4 to 5 shows on our philosophy and approach to retirement planning. Part one should, by the time you listen to this recording, part one should already be available. And we have some really good shows with part 2, 3, and most likely 4 and possibly 5, where we're really going to delve deep into our approach, our philosophy, the why behind everything we do. And that's where everything Chris just said, and he's 100% accurate in it, everything that he said will make sense. But yes, those of you who do not ascribe to our beliefs that your minimum dignity floor is covered with lifetime guaranteed secure income, you need to bucket for that as well. You need to protect that spending, especially that spending. I would argue fund money technically need not be bucketed, even though you never hear me saying that. I disagree passionately with it. But I would concede that fact to some people who believe differently than us, Chris, because they take the approach, well, if the portfolio is down, you can cut your fund spending. It's not a requirement you spend it. So you could cut your spending.
So that would be an argument against bucketing for fund stuff.
Exactly. You'll say you'll just cut it.
Which we won't make that argument because that's the whole point of our process is to
make sure it's there.
Is to make sure it's there so you can spend it.
Right. I don't want you cutting anything because this is it, folks. When you get into retirement, there's no this notion that, oh, in 5 years I'll go or in 10 years I'll go. There's no more. Next exit isn't this world. And you have to recognize that with your retirement. And you don't know how long your go-go period is going to be. And I want our clients to spend as confidently and with as much comfort and clarity as they possibly can have on their fund spending during their go-go phase and not have to cut it. I'll be damned, Chris, if I'm going to cut an elk hunting trip or a salmon fishing trip in my retirement because the market's down.
Yeah, we want you to cut it by choice, or obviously things get cut because of a medical or similar type of an issue. The last thing we want to ever see is someone cut fund spending because they had a inopportune drop in their portfolio value. That is a terrible reason to find yourself having to cut. It should be in your control under your terms, not the dollars that are laying there in your portfolio being the determining factor of when you do things in your life in this phase in particular, because you don't have much time before that choice will be taken from you.
Perfect. Okay, we have another email. This one from a financial planner from Texas, a Texan we call him. And it has to do with variable annuities and bucketing. So I thought it would slide right in. Okay. Hey, Jim and Tonic. So he must be a longtime listener. Mm-hmm. Nobody went with...
That was a terrible joke you played and a few people picked up on it.
Nobody went with Jim and the Fat Man.
True.
That did not receive
any accolades.
Because
most people aren't as rude as you are.
I just thought that was cute. Okay. Hey, Jim and Tonic. Mm-hmm. For those who don't know, go back and listen to older podcasts.
I think they get it. Jim sounds, you know, rhymes with gin. So it's.
And Tonic. Yeah, I like that.
I get it. Right. I don't mind being Tonic.
You didn't want to be Jim and the Fat
it's
Man,
kind
no?
of tart, though.
Tonic?
Tonic alone.
Sweet.
Just Tonic straight?
That's why it's Tonic and not Seltzer. Seltzer has no sugar in it. Tonic has sugar in it. That's why I always ask for a vodka soda, because that'll be Seltzer with no sugar. But if you got a vodka tonic, then you get sugar in it. So I don't think Tonic is bitter.
Yeah. I never drink it without the vodka, so I don't know.
Try it with Seltzer with no sugar.
Oh, I like Seltzer with vodka. Yeah. That's nice. Vodka goes with everything.
Vodka soda, because you can't taste it. When it's well mixed. Okay. Hey, Jim and Tonic.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question on variable annuities. I'm a financial planner that seems to attract clients that have been sold variable annuities by big box companies. Mm-hmm. I want to know how they would fit into your retirement bucketing strategy. I would really like some general information on the thought process you would use when thinking about a variable annuity. Let's say a client and a spouse are both 60 years old and they want to retire in a couple of years. Let's also say they have enough Social Security and pension to cover their minimum dignity floor. They have $500,000 in always taxable accounts and $150,000 of that in a variable annuity. Or is that $150,000 in addition? They have $500,000 in always taxable accounts and $150,000 of that. Okay, so $150,000 of the $500,000 is in a variable annuity. They have no desire to leave a guaranteed inheritance and want to take just a few vacations in their go-go phase. So he laid out a pretty good situation.
Mm-hmm.
So he's a financial advisor, folks, down in Texas, down in the fine state of Texas. And he's saying he's running into a lot of people, in his opinion, who have been sold a variable annuity. I would have to agree with him. Most variable annuities are sold, not purchased.
Yeah. That's an insurance industry joke. Well, it's a joke that people make about the insurance industry.
That they're sold, not purchased. Okay. And he's saying, let's say they had $500,000 in what he called an always taxable account, or what we call an always taxable account. In other words, an IRA. He's got a client with $500,000 in an IRA. Of that $500,000, $150,000 is inside a variable annuity. So the remaining money, $350,000, would be in a regular IRA. That's the situation mm-hmm. he's in. He doesn't make any mention of maybe taxable assets and never taxable assets. He's not saying if they have any bank and brokerage assets or Roth assets. They have no desire to leave any guaranteed inheritance. Okay, that's fairly straightforward. And they want to take a few vacations. So it's telling me they need a little bit of money from that $500,000, not a lot, and that mm-hmm. their pension and Social Security is covering their minimum dignity floor. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the $500,000 is only needed for fund spending. He didn't mention any other goals. We'll assume they have none. So right. it's just minimum dignity floor and fund. That's all that needs to be funded.
So let's evaluate the variable annuity in that context. My first question to them, to anyone, there's always two questions. For those young planners out there, if you ever come across someone with an annuity, whether it's a variable annuity, a fixed annuity, an income annuity, any type of annuity, mm-hmm. or trust, your very first question out of your mouth should be what?
Why do you have this?
Exactly.
What was its purpose? And the answer most of the time is?
I don't know.
I don't know, or I don't remember.
Exactly. So the first thing I would lead in with that scenario you drew out, listener, is to ask that person, why do you have $150,000 of your $500,000? Why do you have, that's about a quarter, isn't it?
Almost. A little less than a third.
A little less than a third. Yeah. That's a good chunk of change. It's a good chunk of change.
30%, actually, exactly.
why do you have that money in the variable annuity? Chances are your client is going to tell you they don't know. And here's the thing. I do agree with you, listener. It was probably sold. Because the variable annuity inside the IRA should have been purchased for one reason and one reason only. One of the guarantees that the annuity could have provided. Because you see, the IRA already receives tax-deferred growth.
Right.
And a big part of an annuity is its tax-deferred growth. Well, inside an IRA, that's a double negative. You already got that. The IRA gives you that. So you should have bought the variable annuity for one of the other protections that an annuity provides. And there's only two others. Principal protection and guaranteed income. Now, the principal protection you're not going to get because it's a variable annuity, meaning the account balance could rise or drop. So there's no principal protection in a variable annuity. This is one of the biggest misunderstandings people with variable annuities have, especially when they come to see me and I ask them, why do you have this annuity? And they say, oh, I didn't want to take any investment risk. Now, some variable annuities do have hedges built into them, and you won't lose as much, but you can still lose. Those annuities, they're called mostly a hybrid style annuity, but they might assume or absorb, if you will, the first 10% drop in the market, and then you absorb everything beyond 10, or the other way around. You absorb the first 10% drop and the annuity absorbs everything beyond 10. So those annuities do exist. So there is some semblance of principal protection, but it's not like a fixed annuity that will give you 100% principal protection. So I don't see any reason to buy the annuity, Chris, for tax deferral. You already get that with the IRA. I don't see any reason to have bought that annuity for principal protection because it's a variable annuity. Now, if you bought a fixed annuity, there's your principal protection. So it leads me to believe it was purchased for income. However, he is saying their pension
and have plenty.
Social Security covers it all,
right.
All their minimum dignity floor.
Right.
They're only taking distributions for a couple of fun things, and they don't want to leave a guaranteed inheritance. So that tells me the final element of an annuity, the death benefit, also isn't needed because you have the tax-deferred growth, principal protection, guaranteed income, and death benefit.
Possibilities. Not all annuities have all those pieces, but they'll have some combination of those. Maybe
correct.
Just one, but they'll have some one piece of those four.
And it tells me your client doesn't need any of that.
Right.
So, and I'm not saying you did it. You clearly are saying these people are coming to you. So he asks us four questions. So I wanted to lay the groundwork, listeners, on why I don't think in the scenario he painted, this person should have been put into a variable annuity. And I don't know if this is a real situation
right.
or if he was making this up, but based on everything he said, I can't see the need for an annuity.
Well,
so
before we go any farther, let me point out the underlying issue here, which is those four features that you described, right? The tax deferral, the principal protection, the guaranteed income or death benefit, those four elements, each one of those, to the extent they exist with this annuity, come at a cost. They're not free in any universe. There's a cost involved. So that's why we're trying to identify which of these things is of benefit to them, because then you can just boil it down to a what are you paying for it and is it worth it? If you don't need any of these, I can tell you right now, you're incurring a cost for something that you're not wanting.
A very
needing.
Steep
yes,
cost.
Right.
And he asks that.
Yeah.
So he asks his first question to us. With that in mind, would you use the variable annuity as the buffer asset and just call it done? No. And here's why. Buffer asset is a term created by Professor Wade Fow. And what he was trying to describe, Fow, like Chris and I, bucket with three buckets. And he has his, I guess you could call it cash bucket or principal, not principal protected, but bucket one, cash, immediate spending. Then he had a third bucket, which was the investments. And he wanted to come up with a strategy of what he called a buffer asset that sat between cash you were going to spend and investments that can go up and down. So if the investments were down and losing money, you didn't fall victim to sequential risk. You had this buffer asset that sat there and it was principal protected. It didn't lose any money. And it could be used to fund spending until the down investment asset recouped its loss and could be spent down again. So he called it buffer asset. So I'm just guessing you read Professor Fow's writings, or you might have heard Chris and I use the verbiage buffer asset before. We call it bucket two, principal protected. But the point is with your bucket two buffer, whatever you want to call it, bucket two, principal protected, buffer asset, whatever you want to call it, the variable annuity doesn't work. Chris, why?
Because it can go down. It's not principal protected.
Exactly. It's not a buffer. If you are suffering a loss in the $350,000 of your client's money in investments, chances are the variable annuity is suffering a loss as well if it's invested. Now, could the variable annuity be inside a fixed account or be inside a bond account? Yes.
And well, other way around. The bond account or fixed account would be inside the variable annuity, not the other way around.
Right. Excuse me. Yeah. Well, I meant the cash inside the variable annuity could be inside one of those investments.
Right.
However, as Chris rightly pointed out, the fees of those variable annuities, or most variable annuities, especially broker-sold ones, are so high, the yield on the cash account in there could be really low, and the bond yield could be really low as well, and you're not getting much. You can get the principal protection, but probably not at any type of return in there. Does that make sense what I'm trying to say there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that was his first question. Would you just use it as a buffer asset and call it done? No, I wouldn't.
Well, let's do one caveat. Could they not be in a VA that would be so expensive to get out of?
He said, that, assuming that...
that the least negative, the least bad thing to use it for
is
might be
asset.
To have it as a buffer asset and intentionally invest it into cash or something
His
like that.
His third
inside.
Question mm-hmm. implies the annuity is out of the surrender period.
Oh, yeah.
So if the annuity was not out of the surrender period, what Chris said is correct. You got to make you got to make lemons out of lemonade, man, and just take the...
Or the other way around.
Huh?
Lemonade out of lemons.
That's what I said.
No, you said make lemons out of lemonade.
Oh, no. Make lemonades out of lemons.
Got it now. Yeah.
Make something sweet out of something sour.
Sure. Nice.
Okay. So if your client can't get out of the annuity because it's in its penalty phase, then yeah, you're kind of stuck using it that
Maybe
way.
Maybe pick the least bad purpose for it. You know, minimize the damage, if you will.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Question two. Would you ever annuitize the variable annuity? Yes, but not in your case. You said the annuity, the pension and their Social Security provided all the minimum dignity floor coverage they needed. Chris and I are hesitant, very hesitant, to annuitize money that is not part of the minimum dignity floor. Annuitization, folks, for those of you who don't know, this particular financial advisor is asking us, would you take the $150 in the variable annuity, tell the variable annuity company, keep the money. We will never have access to the $150,000. And instead, just give us a lifetime stream of guaranteed income. Now, if you shared with us that your clients needed more guaranteed income to cover their minimum dignity floor, I'd be receptive. I'm not saying you would.
Right.
You would have to compare the income from the variable annuity to what you could have got your clients in income from a more traditional income annuity that doesn't have all the fees and expenses of a variable annuity, and see which pays more. But annuitization, Chris and I would be receptive to if your client needed additional guaranteed lifetime secure income to cover minimum dignity floor.
Right, and that's the first thing you'd do that not everyone would necessarily do, especially someone who's looking to sell them another annuity. They would talk bad about what they have now because what they really want is to make a new annuity sale to replace what they have. The first thing an agnostic would do is, if there's income, here's a potential secure income source. Let's look at what it can do. Let's look what it could do versus liquidating it and putting it into something else. They might have something that performs as well or better than what you could, the alternative you could put them in to generate secure income. So there's nothing, again, this is for people who are annuity agnostic, which I put myself in that category, and I think Jim is as well. We talk about them a lot. Some people might interpret that as we are pro-annuity, but that's only because we're not inherently negative annuity, and that's a refreshing. A lot of people are so negative when you hear somebody talk about it with any positivity, it almost sounds like, oh, yeah, they're pushing annuities. No, we're just agnostic. If they're appropriate and for the situation and something a person needs, they are worthy of consideration. But yeah, you should look at what they have right now, yep, potentially. But again, Jim pointed out perfectly that you identified in your hypothetical describing they don't need any more secure income. So there's kind of the answer to your should I annuitize it question.
Then he asks, if the variable annuity is outside of its surrender period, would you close it so you can use the money in your own bucketing system and not have to pay the high fees on the annuity? I think he kind of hit the nail on the head on that annuity. Mm-hmm. Because again, listener, I can't see for the life of me what that annuity is doing. Now, again, I think you're talking about a hypothetical annuity. But if it was a real client of mine, and we would have a discussion very similar to what Chris and I are doing and an analysis very similar to what Chris and I are doing. And if we can find no justifiable reason to keep this annuity going, absolutely I would make the recommendation to the client to close it, because that annuity probably has fees approaching 3%. When you look at all the different fees that a broker-sold variable annuity has, to what is called the M&E fee, mortality and expense fee, the rider fee if it has an income rider, the expenses of the investments themselves within the variable annuity, they can be very, very expensive. And if they do have a rider, the fees on the rider, Chris, are often based on what we call the quote-unquote pretend account.
The phantom.
Which is debited, though, against the real account, the $150,000, but the pretend account is often significantly higher, making the percentage, because it's usually 1%. And it sounds, oh, I'm paying 1% for this rider fee. Well, you're probably paying a lot more than 1% when you understand how or what they apply that 1% to and what account they actually debit that from. So I'm getting a little deep into the weeds there. I apologize. But the point is, listener, yes, if there is no compelling reason for your clients to have the annuity, you've analyzed it 9 times to Sunday, there's no compelling reason, and the clients have shared with you, they're receptive to closing it, that they too can't remember why they even bought it, let alone why they still own it, then sure, if you can save your clients money by moving it out of the annuity and positioning it appropriately, then I see no problem with that. Mm-hmm. I don't. I think that's fine.
And if you've addressed it in that way, then they'll understand why. That's half the battle with, you know, clients. You can sell them things as being a good salesperson, But if you want them to make the informed choice about whether they're going to buy something or choose a particular path, if you educate them and divulge the reasons and they make perfect sense, they'll understand that. That's part of the goal with an agnostic financial planner. You're not trying to sell them anything.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to understand their situation. If anything, you're selling yourself and your expertise, not a product. And a product may achieve for them what they want to do, but it's not really a sales job when all you're doing is describing why it works and they can clearly see, oh, yes. Or you know, obviously sometimes there's not just one thing that works. You can describe a few things, but it's easily justified. Just like selling this particular variable annuity, if that turns out to be your recommendation. You lay it out like we just described. Well, annuities are generally going to do one of these four things for you. Even if this annuity has one of or more of these features, you don't need any of those four things. So maybe we should consider something else. And they'll totally understand that, I would think.
Exactly. Right? And his final question, If the annuity had a guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit, would this change your thought process? Yes, for me. Would it for you?
It would, based on the nature of the withdrawal benefit, what you're paying for it,
right,
and what you're getting out of it, yes.
So let me put in English what he's asking, folks. A lot of annuities, especially variable annuities, and especially variable annuities sold 2000 and onward, they have a rider. This is that extra fee Chris and I were talking about, that will allow someone to withdraw money from the annuity without annuitizing it. Remember, annuitization is where you give up access to the money in the annuity forever. It's no longer there. It's not even an asset. It's gone. You don't list it as an asset on your net worth statement. Instead, it is replaced with a lifetime stream of guaranteed income. And as long as you live, you get money. A withdrawal benefit is different. The $150,000 in the annuity stays there, subject to all the fees and expenses that Chris and I were talking about. Instead, the insurance company is now going to say, we will let you withdraw a certain amount of money from the annuity every year. And as long as you don't take more than that, you could. You don't give up access to the money. The money is yours. You can call the deal off at any time, close the annuity, and take your money and run. But if you don't do that, you leave the annuity open under all the fees and rules that the insurance company is nickel and diming you on, and there's a lot, probably close to 3% of fees. If you simply let it stay open and let them take out 3% of the $150,000, which is what, about $4,500 a year, Let them continue to take out that money every year, they're going to let you withdraw a certain amount of that balance you have. It's your money. They're only giving you your money. So your $150,000 drops by the $4,500 of fees, plus the amount they let you withdraw, and that could be any amount. Let's just say it's 5%. So out of the $150,000, they're going to let you withdraw $7,500. But they're also taking their fee. So about $13,000 a year is coming out of that annuity, plus any growth that it may earn during the year. So you can see, if you took a withdrawal benefit, the money is still yours. So let's say no growth 1 year. You started with $150,000. $13,000 of fees came out, you got $137,000 left in the annuity.
Right. $13,000 of withdrawal and fees.
Right, because you got to count the fees. Right. There's about $4,500 of fees coming out of that, so you got to count that.
Yep.
So now you're down to $137,000. The following year, your fee is going to be nearly the same for a variety of reasons, and you're still going to be able to withdraw your $7,500. So another $13,000 comes out. And it drops it lower, but maybe there'll be a little bit of growth that year, so it recouped some of that. If you continue to do that, eventually, what happens to the annuity?
Eventually, you'll run out of money. If this is what you're wanting out of it, that's not bad news. Because now the insurance company steps in on their guarantee. They haven't done anything. The guarantee hasn't cost them anything at all yet up to this point.
But they've been taking $4,500 a year.
Correct. At the end, you run out of money. Now they have to start giving you, first of all, back some of those fees. You can think of it as that. They're not technically, but it's out of their pocket. So it starts to erode all those accumulated fees they collected. And I guess if you lived long enough, you're going to get all of that back and some money. And I guess you could really consider yourself possibly a winner at that point. Harvesting so much money back out of it.
Exactly.
But yeah, when it goes to zero, the whole point of the guaranteed withdrawal benefit is the guaranteed withdrawal promise still is there. You still get to make those withdrawals, although it's not technically a withdrawal. You're taking insurance company money at that point. They're stepping in and fulfilling the guarantee that you paid them for all this time.
To truly do this analysis, and for anyone who has one of these annuities and is listening, and you're thinking, I don't need it, I'm going to close it. Before you knee-jerk reaction and close it, which was the question you asked in number two, should I just close it? And we said, yeah, I see no problem. Oh, that was question three, actually. Yeah, we have no problem with that. But now you take the question one step further and say, what if there was a guaranteed withdrawal benefit? If there is, I would never knee-jerk react and close the annuity. Here's why. If your clients have longevity, it may be beneficial for them to withdraw under the withdrawal benefit rather than withdraw under the I'm just going to close it and move it. Because look at how long it's going to take for that annuity to reach zero. In my example, I said they're being allowed to take $7,500 a year out. Chances are they're going to be allowed to take more. 5% of $150,000 is $7,500. But it's usually a percentage of what Chris and I call the pretend account on one of these income riders. In other words, they're going to grow this hypothetical account off to the side that grows at a certain guaranteed rate. Most of them will double in a 7 to 10 year period. So let's say your client initially put $100,000 in. 10 years later, it's worth $150,000. Well, the pretend account is probably worth $200,000 or more. Mm-hmm. And you'll get, in my example, I said a 5% withdrawal, which is pretty much industry standard. In my hypothetical, the 5% is not a 5% withdrawal from the 150. It's a 5% withdrawal of the pretend 200. So you're going to get 5% of 200 or $10,000 a year. You only got $150,000 in there. They're taking out $4,500, $5,000 a year in fees, plus another $10,000 of your own money is coming out as part of this withdrawal benefit. That's about $15,000 a year, Chris. It's not going to take long for that annuity to reach zero. And if there's a down market in there, it could reach zero a lot sooner. It could reach zero in as little as 6 to 8 years. And if your client is 65 today, he or she might only be 72, 73, 74 when it reaches zero. And if they were to live another 20 years, the insurance company is going to give them another $10,000 a year or another $200,000. Now, what you have to factor is how much are we going to pay in fees between now and when it reaches zero? Because your client actually to truly break even has to live longer than that because they could close it now. Don't worry about all the fees they paid in the past. That's water under the bridge.
Right.
It's really from the period of time now forward. They could close it now, get $150,000, no penalties, no taxes because it's in an IRA and you can keep it within the IRA wrapper, and they can be out of it. No more paying $5,000 a year in fees. But if they're going to have it emptied within 8 years between the withdrawal and the fees, And if the fees are $5,000 a year, there's another $40,000 of fees they got to pay. So your client needs to live long enough, getting $10,000 a year to recoup, in my opinion, that $40,000 in fees as well.
To justify it more than that even, because otherwise you're not ahead at all, and you've spread
no,
it out over
that number.
No, that's
just to break even.
You're right, exactly, and breaking even over maybe 15 years.
Right.
So that still isn't very attractive. You could have just had that money in a box in your bedroom.
Exactly.
And taken it out.
Exactly.
You got to look at it that way, too. You can't just break even. Breaking even within a year is a whole different story than breaking even within 15 years.
I'm just trying to give them some idea of what to look at.
Right.
Then you have to look at the life expectancy of your client, mm-hmm. and if that income benefit is single life or joint life, can they leave that to a spouse and continue to get it? Okay. So there's a lot of elements you have to take into an account if it has one of these withdrawal benefits. And always remember, your client can call off the withdrawals at any time and take whatever money is left. But every year they keep it open, it's costing them a lot in fees. So it's not an easy answer is what I'm saying. You have to kind of look at it and say, wow, I don't know. Should we take this or not? And a lot is going to depend on when that annuity was purchased, what company it was purchased from, how big that pretend account that's going to set the amount of guaranteed withdrawals at, and how much is the guaranteed withdrawal. In my example, I just said it was $10,000. Maybe it's 12 or 15 or 18 if that pretend account really got big. So you have to look at any number of elements with a withdrawal benefit before telling a client, close the annuity. You have to look at, well, if we kept it open and slowly drained it, would that be a better option?
Right. And what they paid in fees or what they paid for the annuity initially has nothing to do with this. That's what Jim said is absolutely correct. Water under the bridge. You're never getting those back. So even if they got raked over the coals in the past, that should play no part in your decision making. It's all about where you're at today moving forward. The path keeping it, the path not keeping it. There might be other paths to consider, but in our basic example, those are kind of the choices. Keep it, don't keep it. Moving forward, ignoring what's happened in the past, that's how you should do the assessment.
And we're not anti-withdrawal benefit on annuities. I have one. I've said that many times on this show. I bought mine a wicked long time ago, about 19 years ago now. Very long time ago. When they had really good growth in my pretend account. My pretend account grows really good. And I purchased this annuity because I crunched the numbers 9 times to Sunday and thought, it's a pretty good income benefit. Today, they're not so good. And I'm not too much of a fan of them because of the lower interest rates we have now than we did 19 years ago.
Plus, Jim at the time and still today has no pension income.
I have
income,
no pension.
Right? And limited.
I've talked about limited Social Security.
Not the most huge Social Security because of work history. You're going to need some secure income, and
Absolutely.
One way you can get that is through a guaranteed withdrawal benefit.
Correct. So I used that as a tool specifically for me. No pension, very poor Social Security benefits because of all the years I spent as a cop and didn't pay into it, and all the years that I grew this business and wasn't making much in income. My Social Security benefit is relatively low for the lifestyle I lead right now. And because of that, I purchased one of these. So we're not blindly anti these types of annuities. It's just right now, and by now I mean goodness, over the last decade or more, I haven't seen any of these income benefits that, in my opinion, are worth it. And the fees of these annuities just keep going higher and higher, and the guarantees get smaller and smaller. And I just don't like them that much anymore.
Yeah.
But you have to look at them in the context of what your client is trying to do. And for those of you who own these, if you really can't understand why you bought an annuity or why you opened a trust, one of those two, You need to find out and start remembering, why the hell did we buy this? Why the hell did we open this annuity?
And is the need still there? Do I still need it?
Right.
Even if I can figure out eventually, oh, yeah, this is why I got it, or this is why I had the trust built. If your circumstances have changed where the benefit isn't there anymore, don't be paying fees or incurring costs, or, and there's different kinds of costs, there's costs in the form of fees, expenses like that, but there's also costs in the form of giving up liquidity or flexibility. There's other costs to your financial situation. Consider all of that and make sure what you're getting as a benefit is worth it given those costs.
And then one final thing before you close any annuity or counsel a client to close any annuity, look at the death benefit and ask them about their life expectancy. Some of these older variable annuities, not so much the newer ones, but ones that might have been purchased, especially in the 90s when death benefits were huge and living benefits weren't, there may be an incredible death benefit built up that could be substantially higher than even the account balance. You don't see that too often, but sometimes you can. And you would have to be very careful closing the annuity. And if the annuity was bought a long time ago, in the 90s, read or call the insurance company, but I prefer you read the contract, because some will allow you to withdraw a lot of the account balance to a certain level and not lose the death benefit.
Right.
Those are like finding the goose that laid the golden egg, where you might be able to withdraw 60, 70, 80, 90% of the account balance and maintain a massive death benefit. So you really got to look at the death benefit, the rules behind the death benefit, what you're going to get if you closed the annuity or reduced the account balance of the annuity, and make a determination. Some are a dollar for dollar reduction, we call it. So if the account balance has dropped, folks, because the market didn't perform too well and you got $100,000 in, but you have a death benefit that grew because it grew separately under this pretend account strategy, so the death benefit is worth $300,000. Some of the older annuities have a dollar for dollar reduction in the death benefit, not a percentage reduction. Percentage reduction are all the new ones. You take out 90% of your account balance, your death benefit drops by 90%.
Right. Dollar for dollar.
Dollar for dollar, yeah. Says you take out $90,000, your $300,000 death benefit drops by $90,000.
Right.
Now you have $210,000. So, wow, I can get $90,000 out for my client and leave a $210 death benefit. That sounds pretty damn good. So you really got to look at the death benefit. If the annuity was sold in the 2000s, chances are the death benefit isn't going to be worth it. Especially if it was 2008 and earlier, you still might get it. After 2008, probably not. Sometime in the 90s, take a look at it. If they've really had it that long, and be very careful just willy-nilly closing without looking at the death benefit.
Yep.
All right.
Well, that'll bring our, what turned out to be longer than normal show, to an end, even though we still only answered three questions. We're back to our three questions per show.
We did seven last week, though.
Yeah,
we nailed it.
Yeah.
So, on average, we do five questions a show.
Yeah, average over the last two shows. But anyway, if you've got your own question, we encourage you to reach out to us on jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. That's also where you can learn a little bit more about us and the fact that we are practicing retirement planners here in Northern Colorado. We service clients throughout the whole country, though. And on jimhelps.com, you can learn about our philosophy, our approach to retirement planning, the fact that we focus on retirement planning in particular. That is our niche. That is our passion, if you will. And if you're interested in learning more about what we do and how we do things here at Jim Solnier Associates, you can schedule what we call a coffee and a second opinion, where we'll spend some time with you on the phone. We'll describe to you what we do. And actually, we've mix that up a little. Actually, if you're looking at one of those, we'll send you actually a recording of a description of what we do to kind of set the stage for then our live chat where we can concentrate on questions you might have and more specifics to your situation. But in other words, you can find out for free what it is that we do and if it might help you out in your retirement planning situation. We call that a coffee and a second opinion. JimHelps.com, where to find all that stuff. We really appreciate everybody listening in. We'll be back next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit JimHelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
Investors should consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of investment company products carefully before investing. The prospectus contains this and other information about the investment company. Prospectuses may be obtained from your advisor and should be read in full. All guarantees are backed by the claims-paying ability of the issuing insurer. Withdrawals and death benefits are subject to income tax. If withdrawals and other distributions are received prior to age 59 and a half, a 10% penalty may apply. Shares, when redeemed, may be worth more or less than the original cost.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.